Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Jay Ingram. He's written the best-selling series, The Science of Why. The second book in that series, The Science of Why 2, has just hit the bookshelves. The book promises answers to questions about the universe, the unknown, and ourselves. And it does not disappoint. Jay was the host of Discovery Channel Canada's Daily Planet for 16 years, and before that, hosted CBC Radio's national science show, Quirks and Quarks. We look forward to speaking with Jay.
Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is David Schwartz. He's written a new book called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi. He's the father of the nuclear age, published to coincide with the 75th anniversary of Fermi's creation of the first nuclear chain reaction at the University of Chicago, which took place on December 2nd of 1942. The Last Man Who Knew Everything is a groundbreaking new account that considers this brilliant physicist's scientific achievements within the context of his dramatic, complicated life.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we're happy to support KPCW. We are located at 352 Main Street and serve breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are proud supporters of KPCW. We provide up-to-date market information, and our recent market report can be found at bhhsutah.com. Our agents can provide context to these market statistics and can be reached at 649-7171.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Jay Ingram. He's written the best-selling series, The Science of Why. The second book in that series, The Science of Why 2, has just hit the bookshelves. And if you ever wondered, will machines ever have feelings? Was Atlantis a real city? Or how about the Park City favorite cocktail party question? How much do people pee in pools? Well, this is the book for you. With over 36 questions answered with illustrations, Jay Ingram, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, how are you?
We are doing well. How are you this morning?
I'm good, and I have to say the name of your program is the best.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we love the name also. And I tell you what else I love is back a while ago when Star Trek Next Generation came out and they introduced the holodeck, I said to myself, man, I have got to get one of those one day. And as crazy as it sounds, and you talk about this in your book, and I've done a lot of reading about this, is that the simulation technology is going to be a point in the next 20, 25, maybe 30 years where you won't be able to tell the difference between reality and perception. And one of the questions that you ask, are we living in a computer simulation? I found that fascinating. Can we talk about that?
Of course. And I do find that people are kind of split on this, that if you ask that question, you say, how do you know we're not in some simulation that some kid in 2050 is running on his super powerful computer sitting on a couch in his basement, if they still have couches and basements then.
Oh, they do.
And,
they do.
And, you know, people react either by saying that's ridiculous and are totally dismissive. But I think it's intriguing because the question really, everybody knows about The Sims, and everybody also, I think, would acknowledge that at the rate that computer power is increasing, simulations have to become more and more realistic, more and more detailed. And so why couldn't this happen? And the thing is, how would we, if we're little Sims in this future scenario, how are we ever going to figure out that we are? Because everything, like all your thoughts, your entire body and brain, everything around you is all just a simulation. So where, you know, you'd have to find some weaknesses in the simulation, some areas where, like in the movies, they kind of paint the water on the lake kind of roughly, hoping you won't notice that it doesn't look real. And I just think that may not happen.
Exactly. And you talk about being in a virtual reality environment where you're in a warehouse floor standing on concrete, and you believe through the VR that you're walking to this precipice, this edge of a building, and you wouldn't jump. Because if, and I believe this is true, the mind cannot tell the difference between perception and reality.
That was a very weird experience. And I should say that, you know, there are people who would, you know, in this virtual reality situation, be standing with their toes just over the end of a balcony with no railing. And they would step off knowing that it's just a floor. They're going to take a step and hit the floor. But I could not do it. It was such a powerful illusion. And, you know, getting back to this, how would you ever know if you're in a computer simulation? There have been some suggestions, and it's kind of cool and interesting that many of these suggestions come down to, depending on physicists, that if physicists discover a new law of the universe, they might discover that the simulation hasn't appropriately dealt with that. And so there'd be little inconsistencies. But, you know, that's assuming, I don't know. I just, it's one of these really difficult recursive sort of things. Then you say to yourself, but wait a minute. By then they'll know the laws of physics. But wait a minute, we're just making them up if we're in a simulation. It's kind of mind-boggling.
But the laws of physics, especially in the quantum world, it's not the physics of hard answers, it's the physics of possibilities. And quantum has shown us that there's all sorts of, I mean, how would you know if you were in the seventh or the eighth dimension, right? Which I believe you point out in the book, or maybe I read that somewhere else, but anyway.
No, and the other funny part of this is, okay, let's accept that we're in a simulation. What can we do to keep it going? Because it's not in our interests for this hypothetical kid of the future to just shut his laptop or her laptop and go and have dinner. We need it to keep. We would like it to keep going. And I think the suggestions are kind of ridiculous. Like, why don't we elect? I say we in quotes here because I'm a Canadian. Why don't we elect a really a president who's so different from all other presidents that this kid will be intrigued and he'll keep his or her computer open. That's just one idea.
It's good. So, Jay, this kind of brings up another question about the science curious overall. The question that you and John have just pondered, this cyclical, you know, idea of maybe we are just someone else's computer simulation. It's a question that I, if I'm not mistaken, that we all think about when we're children, and through some, I don't know, breach of our curiosity or the fact that we get tied up with other things going on in our life, we stop thinking about it. But I do have this you know, very clear memory of looking at ants, considering ants in a little colony, and thinking maybe we are just the ants, and we're thinking that we're controlling the world, and the ants may be thinking that they're controlling the world. And it's been a long time since I've pondered that. So my question is, you know, what you are doing here is bringing science to the lay people, and how do you best continue creating the questions that you want us to keep alive in our heads?
So, you know, Lynn, I think that it's true that some of the questions, even some of the questions I've addressed in Science of Why and the Science of Why 2, or as we like to call it, Science of Why squared, it doesn't really matter. Some of those questions get re-asked, honestly, every 5 years. Why is the sky blue? Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody asks that. And the answer is kind of interesting, but although it's more interesting to sort of spin it out and talk about the color blue and have we always been able to perceive it. But the way we do the books, at least the first two, and I'm working on a third now, is that the publisher, Simon & Schuster, they get, all the employees get around the board table and they throw out questions that they've been interested in. And some of them are timeless, like the sky blue. Some of them are things I've never really thought about. And then I, too, have questions. I'll give you an example. So, for instance, a few months ago, there was a paper published suggesting that, humans have peaked physically. That is, we're probably not going to live much longer than we do once we get rid of all of the disease challenges to our life expectancy. And we're not maybe going to run and jump all that much faster than we already do. Now, obviously, this is contentious. But if you turn that into the question, have we peaked? That's kind of a cool question. And, you know, because everybody looks back 500 years and says, well, look at the suits of armor. They were tiny people then. You know, that's actually not really true. But in our history as a species, we've gone through, we've waxed and waned in terms of, say, height. Our ancestors a million years ago were actually taller than people living in medieval times, like the year 1000 or 1100. So it's a cool question. It's not a question that it's not a question I think many people ask, but it allows you, one of the things about good questions is that they allow you to spin out the story a little bit more than just the factual response to the question.
Right, which you do so wonderfully in the book, also including all these illustrations that really, you know, if nothing else, just flipping through the book for the illustrations is wonderful. But I wonder if in coming up with the topics for the book, if you encountered a lot of people that came up with the questions that they've always had. And the reason I ask you that is because there's this question that relates to why is the sky blue, which is, do John and I see blue the same? And how would you ever know whether or not the blue for John is the same blue as it is for me? So I would imagine you're getting all these kind of crazy questions that people have wondered throughout their lives.
Yeah. Well, and so that's a question, that's a very difficult question. And I addressed a kind of related one, which was, is it, and I've sort of alluded to this very briefly a minute ago, is it true that in the past, or even today in different cultures, there are colors that people either don't see or don't have a word for? And the argument is that if you go back to the Odyssey and the Iliad, Homer, although, of course, Homer was probably many people who wrote these down, in the Odyssey, there's no reference to the color blue. There's this famous phrase, the wine dark seas. And you go through translations of the Odyssey, and there actually is no reference to blue. And people say, well, how's that possible? I mean, the sky must have been blue. And when the sky is blue, generally lakes and oceans tend to look blue. Yet there's no mention of it. And there have been some cross-cultural studies showing that some groups, it really depends on the, seems to depend on the context in which we live and grow up. There are groups in Africa that have an incredible ability to differentiate very slight differences in green, and yet don't see blue at all, or don't name it, and can't pick it out. Whereas, you know, North Americans, most North Americans faced with that spectrum of greens would see them all as exactly the same, but can see blue. So, you know, your question, do you and John see the same blue? Wow, that's that'd actually be a fun one to tackle.
For book three.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jay Ingram, who has written the series The Science of Why, currently comprised of two books, The Science of Why and The Science of Why Squared. And he's working on a third book. And, you know, I had a thought for your third book, and this isn't a question that people ask all the time, but I think it's an answer that we need to give. It seems like science is always under attack. Maybe you can ask the question, what is the scientific method, and why is it important? Does it work? You know, that sort of thing. We need to get people a little bit more excited about the importance of the scientific process. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I would broaden it a bit and talk about evidence. And, you know, it's pretty clear that in your country, there is fake news, right? So, or at least there are things labeled as fake news. And the respect that I've kind of, you know, had all my life for data and evidence seems to have been diminished. You know, on the other hand, science is not pristine either. And people, I think the most important thing for me is that in controversies that look like scientific controversies, so climate change would be one, where you have extreme skeptics and extreme believers, the really important thing to understand is that at the extremes of that spectrum, the believers and the skeptics, they're not making up their minds based on data. And this has been abundantly demonstrated. They're making up their minds based on social and cultural beliefs that they brought to the table before they even heard about climate change.
That's right.
And they have to do with politics, with resentment of government, you know, whatever. There's a whole set of things. And until scientists accept that and realize that they're not the ultimate arbiter of these things and that they've got to stop the attitude of, well, you don't agree with me on this climate change, but if you knew everything I knew, you would, and so I'm going to dump all this data on you. That doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
If anything, it turns people off.
Yeah, they sort of dig in and even feel their beliefs stronger. So I
that's
agree.
Right. And you know, it applies to both ends of that spectrum, too. So I think that's, you know, most of the people I know believe that climate change is a real threat, but some of them won't even tolerate data that goes against that in any way. And so it's a self-reflective thing. You have to look at yourself and say, am I really listening to all of the information here and making up my mind based on that? It's very, very difficult for humans to do that.
Now, in both books in the series, The Science of Why and The Science of Why 2, you ask and answer about 36 questions or so. And you have several history mysteries, and one of them is I've got to ask you about, because I've never heard of this before, and I was fascinated with what you put together. What is the Antikythera mechanism?
Yeah, so that's a very cool question, and to be quite honest, I wouldn't have thought to ask that question because it seems a little bit, well, the fact that you are unfamiliar with it, it's kind of abstruse, but somebody at the publisher came up with that. So I'll just give you the quick explanation, because it is an amazing, fantastic thing. If you can picture something honestly about the size of a bread box, the old cliche, it was found in a shipwreck in 1905 off the coast of Greece, but it dated back to the time of Christ, so maybe 100 BC or in and around that time. And it turns out to have been a very, very elaborate timepiece with a whole bunch of information in it. So it not only kept calendrical time, but also the times of the zodiac. So you could go into the future and see, you know, when the various signs, where, what dates the various signs of the zodiac were. You could track the five known planets of the time into the future. It could predict solar eclipses, it could predict lunar eclipses, and it had an enormous calendar, not just of the future Olympic Games and what years they'd be falling in, but also subsidiary games that happened every 2 years instead of every four. So the guts of this thing were an absolutely intricate network of gears, the likes of which weren't seen for another several centuries, and maybe even 1,000 years, actually. And so this, isn't that amazing? It's like the reason it was discovered was that there were oyster divers who had to move from their usual hunting ground to another place, anchor because of a storm. And when the storm cleared, they decided to dive there. And they found the shipwreck, and they found the Antikythera mechanism. And it's just this single little light into amazing technology that if it didn't exist, we would think that that period of 1,000 years from the year zero to the year 1,000 was, you know, lacking this kind of expertise. And nobody knows who made it. It's even been suggested that it is so great technologically that it drove thinking about the universe, not the other way around.
Wow, that is fascinating. Let's, Jay, move into some of the lighter aspects, perhaps, of your book. And this was, I'm just delighted by your book, if for no other reason than what I found myself doing this morning. I was standing in the middle of my kitchen, your book in one hand, coffee in the other. I set the coffee down on the counter so I could actually try tickling myself. And then I just chuckled. I know I can't tickle myself, but I had to try. And this is one of the parts in the chapter or the part about the body. Why can't we tickle ourselves?
So Charles Darwin had that figured out. He argued that it's the same as why you won't laugh at a joke that you're telling yourself except to stimulate others to laugh. And it's the lack of surprise.
Yeah.
When you're tickled by somebody else, you may know it's coming, and you may be afraid because of that, but you don't really know exactly when their fingers are going to touch you and where and just how amazingly disruptive it's going to be. And it's pretty well understood now what goes on in the brain to shut down that surprise, and it's pretty simple, really. You make the decision to tickle yourself, as you did this morning. So a part of your brain at the back, the cerebellum, who's kind of coordinating the motion that you're going to make with your hand to tickle yourself, but it alerts the rest of the brain that this is about to happen. And so there is no it's going to happen, and that dampens your response to it. And it's really pretty straightforward. I've not heard of cases where people could tickle themselves. So you know, maybe you could imagine that, but it's just simply the lack of surprise.
I love it. Okay, sticking with the body, the law of urination. Why not? I'm not sure, Jay, if this explains why the line to the women's restroom is always so much longer than the men's restroom. But maybe you can give us a glimpse.
Well, the law of first of all, I love that it's called a law, which yeah. Kind of puts it up there, right, with physics and evolution and so on. Although
it's pretty important.
People still call evolution a theory. The law of urination actually amazingly says that almost all mammals pee for about the same length of time. And I don't have the book in front of me, but I think it's 21 seconds on average,
right,
plus or minus 13, something like that. Anyway,
yes, that's
so it's either just over 10 seconds all the way up to just over 30 seconds, centering around 21. This is the only scientific study I know that was where the data largely came from YouTube videos of animals peeing in zoos. So, you know, people criticize social media, but if you can get scientific data out of YouTube, that's a good thing. And the other part is that the tube from the bladder to the great outdoors, the urethra, is proportionally about the same in all animals. So in a rat, it's a tiny, tiny, thin tube. In an elephant, it's more like, as I said in the book, like one of the pipes under your sink. But given the size of the animal, the size of the bladder, the size of the tube, and the pressure, the bigger the animal, the more pressure is exerted on the flow, they actually kind of congregate around the same number. So It's a lovely little piece of research. The same authors came out with a second paper about poo, not pee. And again, sort of the same thing. I'm really not sure where they got the data.
Yeah. You know, we only have a couple minutes left, but I've got to ask you about your electric eel question. I was so surprised that they had so much power, and yet they have to go through water. So water, of course, cuts down the power a little bit. But can you talk about the electric eels and how they shock their prey?
Yeah, they're really kind of amazing animals, and their bodies are essentially a stack of batteries. So they're built a little bit like your familiar double or triple A battery. So you've got a positive end and a negative end, and they can send out electricity. As a hunting tool, it's a little bit inefficient, as you pointed out, because it's not only is it going through water, which is going to damp, water is a pretty good conductor, so it's not too bad, but it's also going out in all directions. So there's really kind of a two-step part to this. One is the eel will kind of broadcast its electricity, and even at the strength of that, any fish, even if unseen, that fish's muscles will contract in response to the charge, and the eel can sense that because it creates tiny ripples in the water. So then it will, you know, move closer and try and target it better. And the ultimate targeting is where, if you can imagine, there's a fish and then the eel kind of curls itself around in a U shape and basically blasts the electricity right through the fish's body and kills it. They're powerful enough that they can knock down horses. And to make sure that they have enough power for the horse, they'll sometimes, and this has been seen even two centuries ago, jump out of the pond. Let's say a horse is standing in a pond. They'll jump out of the pond, actually attach themselves to the horse's leg, and then electrify. The horse, I don't think they can kill horses, although a horse could be knocked down and drown. That's happened. And they really can't, you know, it would be very, very rare that they'd kill a human. But boy, they're pretty amazing creatures.
And it's demonstrably more powerful than the police department's taser guns.
Yes, and, well, that's all I'll say. Yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
Jay Ingram has written the best-selling series, The Science of Why. The second book in that series, The Science of Why 2, has just hit the bookshelves. We want to thank you, Jay, for joining us, and we want you to come back when number 3 is out, because we need to talk about that.
That would be a lot of fun. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you. Our next guest, David Schwartz, has written The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, the father of nuclear of the nuclear age, when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Jay Ingram, his book, The Science of Why Squared, or 2. Now, we are so excited to speak with David Schwartz. He's written a new book called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, the father of the nuclear age. conducting interviews with many of Fermi's former students, colleagues, and family members, both in Italy and here in the U.S. Schwartz was able to tell, Fermi's story of what it was like for him to live and prosper under Mussolini's fascist regime, his dramatic escape from fascist Italy, and reluctantly participating in the Manhattan Project, where he held such an important role. David Schwartz, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you do a great job as a biographer, and it's not your first book, and so you've had some background bringing the story to the masses, but what was it that first made you want to write a book about Enrico Fermi?
My father was a particle physicist, and he passed away in 2006. In 2013, I was going through some of his papers, and I found an essay by a colleague of Fermi's about his time together with Fermi in Chicago. And this was 20 pages, and I read the 20 pages, and I thought, and this would have been late 2013, and I thought to myself, wow, what an interesting guy. He was at the center of the Manhattan Project, a brilliant, brilliant physicist, really knew everything about physics, was one of the great teachers of his generation, and I wanted to learn more about him, so I went to the library and discovered, to my astonishment, that the last biography of him at that time in the English language had been written in 1970 by one of his students, Emilio Segre. And I thought, this is ridiculous. People don't know about Enrico Fermi. He was one of the most important people in the physics world during his lifetime. He led a dramatic and fascinating life. And it's just wrong that people don't know about him. So I decided to give it a try and write a biography of him. And I'm pleased I was able to get to do so.
I'm so delighted by people like you who decide they want to learn more about something, so they write a book about it. No way to learn better.
Yes, you do learn a lot when you go through the process of doing the research and talking to people.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that Enrico Fermi is more well known in his native Italy. Is that right? Or not?
That is. I'm not sure they know exactly what he did, but you know, there's barely a town in Italy that doesn't have an Enrico Fermi avenue or street or piazza or school or train station. You see his name all over the place in Italy, and they're intensely proud of him. He is, I think they consider him to be the greatest Italian scientist after Galileo, and they adore him. Layman typically doesn't understand exactly what he did, but, you know, many of them know that he was a central figure in the Manhattan Project, and he is very, very well known there, and yet less known here.
David, I was fascinated by the story of when he came to the United States and put his team together in Chicago. It's almost like a thriller as you read it and learning about, well, we're going to try this type of uranium. Water has hydrogen in it, so it's slowing down the neutrons. We can't let that happen. We need to, you know, all the different pieces that went into the first chain reaction of splitting atoms, and it's just a fascinating read. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you found it exciting. You know, I think the story itself is genuinely very exciting, and the outcome, of course, we all know the outcome, but at the time the outcome wasn't known at all to the people who were involved in the project, and the stakes were extraordinarily high, because if the Germans cracked this problem before the United States had, Hitler might have used atomic bombs on Moscow, who they were fighting. They might have used it on London, who they were fighting. They might have even used it on the United States. So, you know, the stakes were very, very high. And no one knew exactly where the Germans were in this process.
And I have to ask you your opinion on this. In 1942, in December of 1942, the first chain reaction was demonstrated. And again, very exciting. And backing up a little bit into the late 30s, I think it was 1938, Lise Meitner, who worked with Max Planck and put together her own team, and she's an extraordinary woman in her own. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
She's the She's the second woman to get a doctorate in physics in Berlin. I mean, how extraordinary is that?
Yeah, and one of the great injustices of the world is that she never won a Nobel Prize.
That is correct.
One of the true great injustices, yes.
That is
correct. But Lise Meitner, yes, she was working on this in 1938.
So the question I have for you is, she didn't do the chain reaction, but she's credited with her team with the splitting of the atom. And this was something that always bothered Enrico, because he was pretty close like 5 years earlier, but they weren't able to make that happen. I was curious, did that disappointment help to motivate him, to propel him, to put together the team he did and to work tirelessly to get to the chain reaction, which is so important to the Manhattan Project? Did Lisa Meitner's accomplishment propel him forward?
Well, I think, you know, what Lisa Meitner and Otto Hahn and a group of other German scientists had been doing is replicating Fermi's experiments in 1934. And Fermi had thought, erroneously, that he was creating elements heavier than uranium. And it turned out that he had really been splitting the atom, and that's what they discovered. So Fermi always called himself the man who missed fission, because, you know, much to his regret, he didn't realize what he was doing at the time. And it was Meitner's huge achievement to figure out the theory behind it. Hahn was a great chemist and discovered what they had been doing, but it was Meitner who discovered the theory behind that. I don't think that Fermi felt... I don't think that motivated Fermi nearly as much as the knowledge that Heisenberg and other German scientists were going to be working on this as well. You know, as soon as the news came over from Europe in January 1939 that the Germans had discovered that the uranium atom was being split, Fermi decided that he was going to do some of his own work in the area, but he was really encouraged by a guy named Leo Szilard, who had this idea in 1934, before any of this work was done, that if you could create a chain reaction where the splitting of one atom would split another atom and onward, you could develop an explosive out of that. And Szilard was in New York when Fermi arrived at Columbia in 1939 in New York. And Szilard was the one who collared Fermi and said, listen, we got to work on this, because if we don't work on this, the Germans will, and they're gonna get the bomb. So it's a combination of things. I think he always felt badly that he didn't realize that the uranium atom could be split. But you know, put that behind him, accepted Lisa Meitner's theory wholeheartedly, and always gave her credit, always gave her great credit for this, and then went on to do the work.
Wow. So all of this great work aside, the story within the story of Enrico Fermi is also the history of his life and what he endured. And maybe it's part of why we don't know about him. Maybe he just wasn't a big self-promoter. But also, I mean, to what degree was his career interrupted, and did he have to sort of start all over again once he fled the fascist Italy? Can you take us through that history? It's really fascinating.
That's really interesting. You know, in 1938, he was the most lionized, the most respected physicist in fascist Italy, most respected scientist in fascist Italy. And then in the summer of 38, they passed some law, anti-Semitic laws, that would have affected his wife, Laura, who was Jewish, so he decided to move to the United States. When he arrived in the United States, you know, he had worked in the United States during the summers or during the 1930s, so people knew him, but they had never really worked closely with him. He was already a legend for the kind of work that he had done. People knew about his work in statistical mechanics. People knew about his work on beta decay theory. And people knew, of course, about the work on neutrons that he had done in the 1930s. And he had just won the Nobel Prize. So it's not as if he had to start his career over again, but he had to develop new working relationships with groups of scientists. And for him, those relationships were always essential. He would never worked alone. He always worked with a small group of dedicated researchers around him who he would teach and he would motivate and work alongside of. And that process had to begin all over again. And he did that at Columbia initially and then at Chicago. So that was the real disruption in his life. He left behind colleagues he adored and had worked with throughout the 1930s, and they ended up scattered all over the world. Some of them stayed in Rome, but some of them came to the United States, and some of them came to Britain. But he had to start all over again in that respect.
Right. And equally interesting is the fact that upon America's entrance into World War II, he became an enemy alien, but working for the U.S.
Absolutely astonishing, isn't it? You know, we think about immigrants today and the big debate about immigrants. And yet in 1941, in December 1941, when the United States and Italy were at war, Enrico Fermi was an Italian immigrant who was a citizen of Italy and immediately became an enemy alien, and yet was permitted to be at the very center of this project that was the most secret project that the U.S. military had going, and played an absolutely central role in it. It's astonishing how immigrants in that period contributed so much to our nation's security and our future.
Yeah.
So he's an Italian national. He's a member of the Fascist Party. He had met briefly with Mussolini. His wife, of course, was Jewish, Nobel Prize. He scooted to the United States from Norway. And his colleagues were so supportive of him and in awe of him, and really thought that he was not only the physicist that he was, but that his heart was in the right place. Yet the FBI was suspicious of Fermi, and they were concerned that there was something going on. And then I found out in reading your book again that everybody that came over, be it Italy, Germany, wherever, they had their mail read by the U.S. Army censors. Did they know that ahead of time, or did they somehow find out that fact?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I do know that Fermi found out about it because he realized that the mail coming in had been opened, and he was very unhappy about that and complained. But it did no good. I mean, they just had this policy of opening everyone's mail. It wasn't simply Fermi's mail; it was everyone's mail. Because they were very concerned about security. You know, this is one of the most astonishing things about the Manhattan Project, is it involved hundreds of thousands of people at the end of the day, people all over the country, most of whom knew nothing about the overall picture of what they were doing. They only saw a little piece of what their particular job was. And yet the entire project was absolutely kept secret throughout the entire war. To the extent, I mean, Fermi was very good about this. His wife didn't know what he was doing until the end of the war. His wife knew that he was involved with a very, very important secret project, but she had no idea it was about building a nuclear weapon. She only discovered that after the war. And you wonder whether under similar circumstances today, whether the United States could pursue, the U.S. government, the U.S. military could pursue a high-level, secure, secret project that's in vital national interest and keep it secret for, you know, the period of time that it was. It's amazing.
Certainly, certainly was. And the humility of his team, just a couple of observations. One is when on the day that they were able to demonstrate the chain reaction. And of course, the Manhattan Project would not have gone forward without this. And you could argue that we could be speaking Germany had already backed out, but certainly Japan, that history could have certainly been different. And it was such a momentous event, yet they were all humbled by the fact, and somebody actually stated that this was a black day for the human race, because they all knew that by demonstrating the chain reaction, that these extraordinary weapons could be produced.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the morning of the Trinity test, or I think it might have been the night before, Fermi was talking to General Leslie Groves, who was the director of the entire project. And the Trinity test, for your listeners, was the first atomic test that took place in the the Mexican desert. And Fermi said, listen, you know, if it doesn't work, at least we'll know, we'll have the benefit of knowing that, you know, nuclear weapons can't be built. You know, Fermi was thinking that that would be a wonderful outcome to all this.
Yeah.
I mean, they all knew that this would, if it was possible, it would be devastating. And, you know, it would unleash unprecedented destructive power. Then they all were keenly aware of the magnitude of what they were doing. So, they were very humbled in the face of that and understood what... but I think their attitude was, unfortunately, the Germans have the same information that we have. They have very good scientists. If they get this before we do, we are going to be in a very, very bad situation.
Right. Take us back. Was that first test, the Trinity test, was in 1942, I believe, again at...
No, 45.
Oh, 45.
Right.
Again at what is now known as the White Sands missile testing area.
Yes, exactly.
Take us there. Fermi got in, he actually got in trouble for saying some offhanded comment about melting off the face of the Earth or something like that.
Yeah,
and
he
then...
was taking bets. He was taking bets on whether the Earth's atmosphere would be burned up in as a result of the test. And yes, he got a dressing down for that.
Absolutely. But just so we can understand the magnitude, of course, we've all seen the images on TV, but describe that day and the fact that Fermi, in the end, he decides to position himself as close as anyone to the actual detonation, which is about 10 miles away, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he, you know, that morning it was raining, and they almost called off the test, but it stopped raining, and at 5:30 in the morning, they detonated it. And I love, there's a description. A lot of people who witnessed it described it, but Joan Hinton, who was one of Fermi's colleagues, said it was like being at the bottom of an ocean of light. So all they could see for the first second was just light. They couldn't see anything else. It completely whited out the entire landscape. And then the light passed over them, and they could see the mushroom cloud. And Fermi counted out about 40 seconds to when the blast wave would hit him, which would feel like a big gust of wind, and you'd hear a roar. And he took out of his pocket some strips of paper that he had prepared and tossed them up into the air when that blast of wind came by. And he watched how far those strips went, and he had done a calculation, and he measured how far they went and was able to determine how powerful the blast was because of the distance of those pieces of paper. That was classic Fermi, a quick and dirty experiment that got a reasonably correct answer. So that was what it looked like. But I think I love Joan Hinton's description, at the bottom of an ocean of light.
Yes. Wow. What's your favorite, anecdote, the thing that really endears you most to Fermi?
Oh, I love this this quote that I found in the book by Emilio Segre, which is he was at Berkeley in 1940, and was delivering a lecture, and he went in to sit in on some other lectures that were being given at the time. And the style of physics that was being done at Berkeley was very different from his. It tended to be a little bit more elaborate, a little bit more self-conscious, a little bit more... I hate to use the word because I love my friends at Berkeley, and I'm not a physicist myself, but I think that Fermi considered it pretentious. And so Fermi later said, he sat in on this lecture, and he later told Segre that he must be getting old and rusty because he was sitting through this lecture and he couldn't follow it at all. And he was getting more and more depressed. And finally, but he just was about ready to give up, but the last sentence of the lecture cheered him immensely. He said, the last sentence of the lecture was, and this is Fermi's theory of beta decay. So he was listening to a lecture about his own theory and, you know, just commenting on how pretentious they had made the theory. He was a radical simplifier and loved to simplify things so that anyone could understand them.
That's a great story. I would say that a lot of not only physicists but just writers in general would say that about critical review of their own books. Like, what are they talking about?
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with David Schwartz. He's written The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. One of the quotes that you have in here, and it, you know, I imagine he would say this with the enthusiasm that I might say to Lynn, "I think I'll have tomato soup for lunch," a very casual comment. He's walking back to the laboratory with Teller, and he says, you know, now that we have a good understanding of this atomic bomb thing, why don't we start replicating the reactions in our own sun? And it hadn't even been confirmed that that the sun was one giant hydrogen atomic reaction, and yet he's just so casual about this. And of course, from that comment, Teller was just, you know, just thought this was the right thing to do, and he spent the rest of his life working on that. It was just so casual.
Yeah, well, you know, Fermi would toss out ideas fairly casually that other people would pick up and run with. That particular conversation took place in late 41 or early 40.
Did we lose you?
Oh, the launch. And, Teller said, you know, this was something that interested me, which is one of the great understatements in scientific history, because he became obsessed with the idea of how to build a hydrogen bomb. But Fermi also did this at least one other time of note, which is in the early 1950s, a friend of his named Maria Mayer, who was on the faculty at Chicago, was struggling with the problem of how to understand the way atomic nuclei are structured. And she was struggling. There were some interesting things that she had found. But she needed something to tie it all together, and she's chatting with Fermi, and Fermi says, "Why don't you look at spin orbit coupling? A spin orbit coupling is a fairly complicated concept that relates the way the individual particles in a nucleus behave to the overall behavior of the nucleus itself. It ties the behavior of the particles to the overall nucleus." And she looks at him and says, "Oh, my God, Enrico, that's the solution." And Enrico says, "Well, how do you know? You have to work it out." She says, no, I can work it out, but that's the solution. Well, it turned out that it was, and she came back to him 2 weeks later and said, "I'd like to put your name on the paper." And he said, "No, that's ridiculous. You did all the work." Well, in 1963, she won a Nobel Prize for that paper.
Wow.
You know, and that's the kind of just, you know, toss off a casual comment that turns out to be pretty significant.
Yeah.
So he did that a number of times.
Wonderful. David Schwartz, he's the author of the book, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. It's a great book, David. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
And I think I'm going to have to give this book over to the one and only person that I asked, "Hey, do you know who Enrico Fermi is?" And sure enough, he said, "Yes, I do." The
Who's
Fermi
that?
Labs, Bruce Erickson,
okay.
Our planning director.
Well, let's get that to him.
I know. But I think I need to read it cover to cover first. This is a great book. Well, I want to thank our underwriters today, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity, Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. And you've been listening to KPCW Park City.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Want to thank our guest today, Jay Ingram of The Science of Why, and